Today is Friday, June 11th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden prepares for G7 summit.
200 million of these Pfizer vaccines will be delivered by the end of 2021 and 300 million by June of next year.
Plus, UN warns Tigray faces a growing food crisis.
It is, according to the UN's aid chief, the worst food crisis anywhere in the world in a decade.
Also, New Zealand develops bug tracking drones. Our top story today is in the UK. The G7 summit opens Friday in Cornwall, England, and Western leaders will pivot from opening greetings and a family photo op directly into a session on, quote, building back better from COVID-19, unquote. On Thursday, US President Joe Biden formally announced that his administration is donating 500 million doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to 92 low- and middle-income countries. Here's the latest from White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara, who is traveling with the president.
Following his summit with this year's G7 host, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a major announcement from U.S. President Joe Biden.
The United States will purchase 500 million doses of Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine to donate to nearly 100 nations that are in dire need in the fight against this pandemic.
200 million of these Pfizer vaccines will be delivered by the end of 2021 and 300 million by June of next year. They are in addition to the 80 million already committed by the U.S. to be delivered by the end of the month.
Our vaccine donations don't include pressure for favors or potential concessions. We're doing this to save lives, to end this pandemic.
By announcing his vaccine donation plans on the eve of the G7 summit, a meeting of the world's leading industrial nations, Biden is pushing the group of wealthy countries to follow his lead. He is also rejecting accusations that the U.S. is a vaccine hoarder. Leslie Vinjamuri directs the U.S. and America's program at Chatham House.
He's trying to signal that America isn't intensely parochial and inward focused, which I think has been a deep concern not only through the Trump years, but quite frankly through the pandemic. When for so long the United States just simply wasn't sharing the vaccine. So I think this is, he's come under pressure globally to do this, to take a leadership role.
Hours after Biden's announcement, Johnson said Britain would give at least 100 million surplus vaccine doses. He expects the G7 to agree to donate 1 billion doses during the summit, scheduled to begin Friday. Pfizer makes mRNA vaccines, produced not by using weakened forms of the virus, but by using the pathogen's genetic codes. CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla.
So far, data show that none of the existing variant strains has escaped the protection provided by our vaccine.
While activists welcome Biden's move, they want wealthy nations to do more to help vaccinate the world, especially those nations that have more doses than they need in the pipeline. Tom Hart is the acting CEO of the One Campaign, an organization that works to end poverty and preventable diseases.
While those doses don't exist today, and of course countries have an obligation to really accelerate the vaccination programs of their domestic populations, they have purchased contracts for more than they need. They need to negotiate now to direct those surplus doses to countries in need. This is the urgent thing that the G7 needs to agree.
The doses will be delivered through COVAX, the United Nations vaccine sharing mechanism. It will cost American taxpayers $3.5 billion, $2 billion of which will be paid with funding already pledged to COVAX. Traveling with the president at the G7 in Cornwall, Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is set to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden on Monday on the sidelines of the coming NATO summit for discussions seen as pivotal, given the strained relations between the two nations. From Istanbul, Dorian Jones has this preview.
Among the most challenging tasks facing President Joe Biden during his stay in Europe will be his meeting next week with his Turkish counterpart, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. That's because bilateral relations are near breaking point, warn some analysts.
There have always been periods of troubles, disagreements, divergences, etc. But what we are experiencing currently is probably the rock bottom, I mean, in the relations. So either the relations will recover at one point, or probably, I mean, they will break irreparably and irreversibly.
One point of tension, the US expulsion of Turkey from its F-35 fighter jet program after Ankara purchased Russia's S-400 anti-aircraft missile system. Washington says the purchase undermines NATO defense systems. Turkey's relationship with Russia is one of many differences between the allies. Erdogan's crackdown on domestic dissent prompted Biden to call him an autocrat last year during the US presidential election campaign. Biden is making the promotion of democracy worldwide a fundamental tenet of his foreign policy. Erdogan, too, has grievances. Washington is backing Syrian Kurdish forces who were instrumental in fighting the Islamic State, forces that Turkey considers terrorists. But Ankara sees the Erdogan-Biden meeting as an opportunity for a reset, according to a presidential advisor.
I believe in Turkey's bag there will be key commitments that will open a new page in bilateral relations. Turkey is willing. But there is no room for dreams in real politics, only rationality. America is a pragmatic country. America should think what the cost is of losing Turkey.
In a bid to remind NATO of Turkey's importance, Erdogan said Turkish fighter jets will soon be sent to the Baltics in support of its allies as they face off against Russia. But a Reuters report quoted diplomats saying Turkey pushed NATO allies to water down NATO's condemnation of Belarus for intercepting a civilian plane. That was widely interpreted as a pro-Russian gesture. Erdogan insists Turkey can have good relations with both Moscow and the West. But the likely message from Biden to Erdogan, according to one analyst, is that he may have to choose between the two by giving up Turkey's Russian missiles.
Keeping both Americans and the Russians happy is not within the realm of possibility. So Erdogan is, unfortunately, is hard-pressed to make a very hard choice. It's time for him to make a hard choice. And I don't see if he can postpone such a crucial decision.
Yet Erdogan and his ministers have repeatedly said the Russian missiles will stay, calling it an issue of national sovereignty. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Ransomware cases are up on the rise worldwide, and criminal groups based in Russia are suspected of being behind some of the biggest recent attacks. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports on the changing world of ransomware.
Testimony you will
Colonial Pipeline CEO Joseph Blount recalls the moment he decided to pay $5 million in ransom to hackers who cut off the company's access to internal files.
It was the hardest decision I've made in my 39 years in the energy industry, and I know how critical our pipeline is to the country, and I put the interests of the country first.
Colonial is among the recent victims in the U.S. of what experts say is a rising tide of ransomware cases, computer system attacks that hobble operations until the organization pays a ransom. Over the past year, hackers have targeted critical infrastructure, hospitals, transportation agencies, food suppliers. Operations are borderless, and payment is in cryptocurrency, making it hard to catch the criminals. Hackers use multiple ways to exploit computer system vulnerabilities, including phishing emails that trick employees into opening attachments that launch the malware that infects the network. Once in, the hackers lock down the system, encrypt the locks, and leave instructions on who to pay to unlock the system. Hackers copy sensitive files and use the threat of releasing the files publicly as a threat in payment negotiations. Once paid, often by cryptocurrency that is hard to trace, the hackers provide decryption keys to unlock the files. The newest twist is the professionalism of hacking. Hackers offer ransomware software so that criminal organizations can get in on the action, experts say. Raj Samani is the chief scientist with McAfee. He spoke over Zoom at a recent Aspen Institute event.
The bad guys have got better, and we've effectively completely lost sight of the true nature of the problem, which is there is now this affiliate or partner model, and they're effectively going out and hiring individuals to break into companies to exploit vulnerabilities that, quite frankly, are not sophisticated.
Officials say U.S. law enforcement recovered $2.3 million of Colonial's ransom, money that reportedly was going to a Russia-based gang of cybercriminals. Next week, President Joseph Biden is expected to raise the issue of Russia as a haven for cybercrime with Russian President Vladimir Putin when the two leaders meet in Geneva. The involvement of Biden and European leaders is a signal that these hacks are being taken more seriously, say experts. Philip Reiner is the CEO of the Institute for Security and Technology.
They're going to be taking more and more steps to actually come after this, not anymore just as a cybercrime challenge, but as a national security threat. And that will bring significantly more resources to bear on the problem.
The Biden administration has issued a warning to all organizations, from big business to small towns, that now is the time to improve their cybersecurity and defend against ransomware attacks. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The international community is urging a ceasefire in Ethiopia's Tigray region, which the UN has said is facing the world's worst food crisis in a decade. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
It is, according to the UN's aid chief, the worst food crisis anywhere in the world in a decade. Some 350,000 people are in famine conditions in Ethiopia's Tigray region. Mark Lowcock said that's higher than anywhere in the world at any moment since a quarter of a million Somalis lost their lives in 2011. The cause, according to United Nations agencies and aid groups, is man-made. The Tigray conflict between federal forces and the TPLF has killed thousands and forced 2 million people from their homes. And for Asta, not her real name, it's taken away everything. She says she lost her home, her cattle, and her crops in an attack, leaving her family with no means to survive.
They kept getting closer, burning all the harvested crops and straw, and continued setting fire to everything. They burned everything I had.
Tigray's famine numbers came on Thursday from the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. It's a scale used by UN agencies, regional bodies, and aid groups to determine food insecurity. IPC said more than 350,000 people are at Phase 5, the scale's most extreme warning before an official declaration of famine in the region. That means households are experiencing famine conditions, but less than 20% of the population is affected, and deaths and malnutrition have not reached famine thresholds. But Ethiopia's government disputes the IPC findings, saying food shortages are not severe and humanitarian aid is being distributed.
Intervening with humanitarian assistance.
According to the UN, most of the 5.5 million people in Tigray need food aid. But Luca Russo, a senior food crisis analyst at the Food and Agriculture Organization, said parts of Tigray are inaccessible.
I mean, to be very honest, people are at a starvation level with excess mortality, wasting a very high level of wasting for children, and basically not be able to access enough food to eat.
In a joint statement, the United States and the European Union called for an immediate ceasefire, warning that the humanitarian crisis in Tigray threatened to destabilize the wider Horn of Africa region.
That's David Doyle of Reuters. Myanmar authorities have opened new corruption cases against deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi, accusing her of abusing her authority and accepting bribes, state media reported on Thursday. Allegations her chief lawyer said were, quote, absurd, unquote. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Myanmar slammed more charges on deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi on Thursday. The latest are the most serious allegations yet. Corruption charges that could land her up to 14 years in prison. The military-controlled media said the new cases related to the misuse of her charity funds that she chaired and illegally accepting 600,000 and over 11 kilos of gold. Her lawyer called the allegations absurd. Since the military seized power in a coup on February 1st, charges have piled up against Suu Kyi. Already, she faces six other charges, ranging from illegally importing walkie-talkies to breaching coronavirus regulations during her party's election campaign. Her supporters say the charges are politically motivated. Since the coup, Myanmar has been plunged into crisis. The army's violent crackdown has forced more than 100,000 people to flee in the north, according to the UN, and more than 800 people have been killed and nearly 5,000 detained, according to the monitoring group Assistance Association for Political Prisoners.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. The UN Human Rights Chief is warning of a military buildup in parts of Myanmar and rising violence, with the army using heavy weapons against armed groups as well as civilian targets. Michelle Bachelet on Friday condemned what she called the, quote, outrageous, unquote, use of heavy weapons on civilians. She also said more than 108,000 people have fled their homes in eastern Kaya State in the past 3 weeks, and her office cited, quote, credible reports, unquote, that security forces have shelled civilian homes and churches there while blocking access for humanitarian aid. Her office cited reports that at least 860 people have been killed by security forces since the military seized power from an elected government in February. She also said that since the coup, the country has become a, quote, human rights catastrophe, unquote. This is the Voice of America. The departing chief of Israel's Mossad intelligence service has offered the closest acknowledgement yet. His country was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear program and a military scientist. Yossi Cohen's comments on national TV offered an extraordinary debriefing by the head of the secretive agency in what appears to be the final days of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government. His comments also gave a clear warning to other scientists in Iran's nuclear program that they could become targets. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A new report finds 160 million children, or nearly one child in 10, is involved in child labor globally, an increase of 8.4 million since 2016. A joint report by the International Labor Organization and UN's Children's Fund warns the COVID-19 pandemic is worsening an already alarming situation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the report is being launched in advance of the World Day Against Child Labor on June 12th.
The data show nearly half of these children, or 79 million, are involved in hazardous work, 6.5 million more than in 2016. Hazardous work is considered as among the worst forms of child labor. It is dangerous, harmful to a child's physical and mental health, and could result in death. The ILO report, 70% of children work in agriculture, most on family farms, 20% in services, including domestic work, and 10% in industry. The picture that emerges from this study varies by region. The report finds child labor is continuing to decrease in Asia and the Pacific, as well as in Latin America and the Caribbean. However, child labor has risen substantially in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. ILO Director General Guy Ryder says in Africa as a whole, 20 million more children are in child labor today than they were 4 years ago. Of those, he says 16.6 million are in sub-Saharan Africa. Executive Director of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, expresses concern at the alarming rise in younger children who are toiling in child labor. She says half of all children in child labor around the world are aged 5 to 11 years. She says the COVID-19 pandemic is making this terrible situation even worse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A swarm of bug-tracking drones and a tiny radars have been developed to help conservation of rare insects in New Zealand. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The new tag-and-track technology is being developed at the University of Canterbury on New Zealand's South Island. Researchers hope it could lead to a deeper understanding of New Zealand's threatened and endangered insects. The research draws on years of experience in the area of bird conservation, where radio tracking methods have helped to protect many vulnerable species. Experts have said that, at a stretch, the technology could also be used to study large invertebrates, such as giant land snails, but was simply too big and heavy for most insects. Researchers have now made about 20 tiny so-called harmonic radar tags that are fitted to insects. They would then be tracked by a swarm of drones. Steve Pawson from the university's College of Engineering says bird tracking technology has been a major inspiration.
I've been doing radio tracking on many of these species over several decades now, and the information that they learn from that really informs the conservation management. So understanding how far do these things move, where do they go foraging, what are their foraging behaviours, even things as simple as how long things live for. Unfortunately, the radio tracking technologies that are out there at the moment are too heavy to use on small insects. There's only a handful of our heaviest insects that can carry those. And so we're really limited in our understanding of how invertebrates are moving through the environment. And if we have that knowledge, then we can incorporate it in our decision-making and in our planning for conservation management operations.
Trials will start on ground-based insects before the New Zealand team tries to tackle the complexities of tracking insects in flight. Field testing could begin in 2023. Academics have said the study could also have applications in other disciplines, from biosecurity to medical imaging. Among New Zealand's endangered insects is the iconic weta. They're one of the South Pacific nation's most recognisable creatures, with their large bodies, spiny legs and curved tusks. Several species of weta are under threat from predation by birds and reptiles and habitat loss. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
NASA sends squids to space. Plus, the world's wealthiest man makes out-of-this-world travel arrangements, and a soccer star talks game with an orbiting astronaut. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us the week in space.
2, 1, 0. Ignition.
This week, from a launch pad at Florida's Cape Canaveral, private spaceflight company SpaceX launched its 22nd commercial resupply services mission to the International Space Station. The CRS-22 delivered more than 3,300 kilograms of cargo, including the first two new solar arrays to help power the ISS. Also on board CRS-22 were 128 newly hatched bobtail squid. Sea creatures in space are part of an experiment called Understanding Microgravity on Animal-Microbe Interactions, or UMAMI. The University of Florida's Jamie Foster explains why.
We all have microbes that are helping our bodies with our digestive system, with our immune systems. Microbes are essential for our health, animal health. And so what we don't really understand, the full mechanisms of communication, the dialogue that's happening between microbes and animal cells. And we know even less when we're in the space environment.
Foster says the project aims to understand how the stressors of space impact the healthy interactions between microbes and hosts. She says squid have similar immune systems to humans, but as they are simpler animals, researching their microbial interactions makes an easier model to understand the effects of space flight on more complex animals like humans. Which could be good news for the world's wealthiest human. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos announced this week his plans to join the first crew aboard his Blue Origin capsule.
You see the Earth from space, it changes you. It changes your relationship with this planet, with humanity. It's one Earth. I want to go on this flight because it's a thing I've wanted to do all my life. It's an adventure. It's a big deal for me.
It will likely also be a big deal for Bezos' brother and fireman, Mark Bezos, whom Jeff invited along for the 10-minute hop aboard the New Shepard suborbital vehicle. It will be the first time a capsule with crew flies attached to the New Shepard, and its flight date of July 20th falls on the anniversary of the 1969 Apollo 11 moon landing. And finally this week, a video call between French ESA astronaut Thomas Pesquet and French soccer superstar Kylian Mbappe. Pesquet, floating aboard the ISS, compared the flight to space to a roller coaster ride with 10,000 times the power. He also complained to Mbappe about the difficulties of playing soccer in space, saying the ball goes up but never goes down. Mbappe will soon be playing soccer on Earth at the pandemic-delayed European Football Championships. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. and have a great weekend.